Hello, hello. You're listening to the Goggler Podcast. Ian Bahir and Uma with you. And TV is good this week. Have we got a show for you? We're talking about all good things this week. We're going to be reviewing Netflix's Sweet Tooth, which is an adaptation of the classic Vertigo comic by Jeff Lemire, as well as Marvel's Loki, which is their third installment in Phase 4 of the MCU.
And so far, nothing in the phases connect to anything else.
So far, there's a lot of setup. A lot of setup for a lot of stuff. But we're going to kick things off with Sweet Tooth. This one dropped last week on Friday. And I felt it was a relatively quiet drop on Netflix. There was very little hype behind this series. I mean, yet again, not as much as like Umbrella Academy or Stranger Things. And initially, when they didn't assign screeners, I was a little concerned, because normally when they don't assign screeners to something like this, it usually means it's bad. And boy, was I wrong. My God, this show is so good. Like, I'm a fan of the comics. I'm a huge fan of Jeff Lemire. Like, it goes on my, like, I tell the comic shop guy, pull anything that has his name on it, because I think he's a fantastic writer. And Sweet Tooth was something I read when it first came out. And I know you did the same thing, Ian. You kind of mainlined the comics over a weekend, and I did that too. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been like 6-7 years since I've read it the first time, and I really enjoyed reading those 40 issues again. And this series is a fantastic adaptation in that it changes so much of the comic. I mean, it takes the core idea and then completely runs with it in a slightly different direction, but a really good one.
Yeah, I'm currently at around 1,500 words on why it's like the amazing adaptation. Of like an actual adaptation as opposed to a translation to the screen. And this is in a year when we've already had adaptations that worked within their own vibe, as it were, with Invincible, or even looking last year, the year before, with The Boys. Like, those are great adaptations, but they also have the same vibe. This is a very unique beast in that it literally takes what's good about the story. And this is not to say that it's any better or worse than the comic. The comic is still great. But it really does take it in a drastic new direction. And unlike something with like Jupiter's Legacy, all the stuff they add is gold. It's not dirt. It's not sawdust. It's like they've changed core tenets of some of these characters, which I think it's down to, I think I keep thinking back to The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead, when I left, it was about 8 seasons in of them walking from place to place, finding a group of allies, getting inevitably curse your inevitable betrayal, losing a few people, picking up a few more allies, moving on, rinse, repeat, lather.
That's the show, right? Yeah.
That's the show. And when mainlining these comics last week, because, you know, I was aware of Sweet Tooth because you'd see it in, like, it's one of those indie Vertigo darlings. But after reading it, there is an awful lot of walking and there is an awful lot of betrayal. And no offense to Jeff Lemire's art, but it does give it a completely different vibe.
But that was the point of the comic, right? The comic was meant to be dismal in every sense. Like, yeah. So even the landscape that you see in the comic is depressing. It is truly post-apocalyptic and sad. Meanwhile, I love what they did with this series in that they've created a landscape that is in contrast with what the world is actually going through. You see these beautiful vistas over Yellowstone, and the world is beautiful, but what humanity is experiencing is really shit. And I love that dichotomy. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, it has. When I saw that first trailer, I thought, oh, they've screwed it, because it has, I didn't realize.
It looks really clean, right?
Yeah, it has that kind of an uplifting version of Duran Duran's Ordinary World on it. And when you get to that first episode and there's the Monsters and Men song that comes up, Dirty Paws, and it's that Appalachian Urban Outfitters plaid shirt vibe,
right
it feels poor, you know, maybe, you know, it feels like South by Southwest darling kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And even when you see its logo, which has the Sweet Tooth is a kid with antlers, but when you see a logo with antlers these days, it looks like it's come off Canva or some other, you know, so many design companies' Instagram branding just has like antlers in there for no reason. And it's so amazing that it veers away from that. Like, it doesn't, I only realized thinking about this, it never really rains on them. Like, they never have to deal with the harshness of hiking. right?
Maybe it was the season. Never rains.
It never rains. But that doesn't mean that it goes twee at all. Like, they actually, the stakes are still there. The jeopardy is just there. They just concentrate on the right things. They don't need to see them tired from hiking for days and days and days. Instead, the threat comes from somewhere else. So yeah, we should get to the synopses.
I mean, yeah. The comic and the series follows a dear boy, if you will, right? He's a hybrid human called Gus, and he makes his way through this world, which has kind of been ravaged by two potentially connected events. There is a virus that has plagued the planet and killed off most of the Earth's population, and all the babies that are born are kind of half human, half animal hybrids. And we don't know if they're connected. We don't know if one caused the other. And that's the mystery at the core of this series. And Gus meets a former American football player called Jeopard. And both of them go on this sort of adventure together. He's in search of his mother. And Jeopard has an interesting backstory. And you don't know what he's looking for, whether he's looking for redemption for a past sin or what, right? I mean, we discover that as the series unfolds. And what was... like, the kid, I mean, Christian Convery is phenomenal. Like, he carries this thing on his back. He's one of these things. He's one of these kids that's precocious but not annoying. Like, there are so many kids on TV that can be written as precocious and annoying. And he finds this right balance of being cute, adorable, strong, which is very different from the depiction in the comic book, where he's kind of... he's a little bit dumb in the comic book to begin with, right?
Right.
Well, it's that drawl, really, that they give him, that he may or may not be dumb, but when you make him sound like a redneck hick, it doesn't help when it's written like, I don't know about that boy. Whereas losing that helps. The ears also help a huge amount.
Yeah.
he has these big deer ears that like, ever since, they're the most expressive, like, prosthetic since, like, the Tick had his antennae in the live-action TV show. Like, they just, when you see them flicking, you know something's up. It's absolutely magical when you see that.
But hey, you've not read the comics, right?
Yeah, I haven't read the comics, but I think coming into it, the lead character, what was his name?
Christian Convery.
So I think he really sort of sold it for me. You're right, he's precocious, but not annoyingly so, but at the same time, there's an innocence to it. He brings an innocence that you believe that he has not been around other people at all, other than his father, for 9 years, 10 years of his life, right? There's a curiosity he brings, there's a naivete that he brings, but there's also a quick to trust, but also quick to pull away from. And I think that balance that he does is really amazing. I think a lot of the show hangs on close-ups of his face emotionally.
The show is mostly about him. Like,
he carries most of it, yeah.
They found an actor who embodies what Jeopard says about him, is that kid's got hope coming out of every pore, is one of the lines in one of the later episodes. And he does. And that's not... I never quite got that from the comic.
Right, right.
Oh, from Gus? Right, God, no. Because Gus is so lost in the comics, right? And he really... in the comics, that's the big character distinction between what they did in the series and what they did in the comics. In the comics, Gus is completely untrusting of the world because his father has taught him, you cannot trust anyone. You cannot leave this compound because everyone out there wants to kill you.
Is the age the same in the comics?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Gus in the series is like you said, Bahe, that right balance of both, in that he's untrusting, but he wants the trust. So when he meets new people along the way, there is a sense of not, I wouldn't say naivete, but I guess like hopefulness that, oh, is this a good person?
Mm.
And
do they have something sweet?
Do they have something sweet?
I wish they played that up a little more. I'm assuming the comics played that up a bit more.
They play up the chocolates quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's what they, because the kids haven't had chocolate, so it is what a lot of the poachers and hunters use to trap them. But it really is like they've run the plot lines through a graphic equalizer. Like, Will Forte is delightful as Gus's father, whereas in the book, you know, he, before his exit from the story, he is more of an apocalyptic madman.
Right.
Like a kind of a, there's a religious element that comes into it, that he has a Bible written and stuff like this. Jeopard himself is a far more deeply conflicted character. In this, he's been through some stuff, but he's kind of better now.
He's come out on the other side, right?
Yeah, whereas in the comic, it's kind of like he's always in it.
Right.
Like, and there's some of the betrayals there. You'd have to I mean, No offense to the actor playing him, Nonso Anunzi. I think changing him from a hockey player to an American football player works perfectly for that guy. I mean, maybe he is an angel on the ice. I don't know, but it does make more sense. But you would have to be a hell of an actor to pull off some of the betrayals that that character has to go through. And I don't know whether that would turn people off.
I think it would be a lot harsher. I mean, the first arc of the comic series ends in a huge betrayal between Jeopardy and Sweet Tooth and Jeopardy and Gus. And
yeah,
it's very difficult to come back from. I think in comics, it's easier to pull off. But on a TV show, when you're trying to build a relationship between these characters, it's something that's very hard to come back from. Yeah.
But then they also just do things that are completely fresh. Like there is an animal army in the comic that is completely different motivations and completely different storyline. And the kids' whole cloth. I think it's Becky is one of the characters. It's Lucy and Becky, right? I think it was Becky was the blonde girl. But it's a completely different character. But it works.
Because in the comic series, there's a whole thing, like you said, there's a religiosity to it. There are these prostitutes that they save.
No, they're not prostitutes. They're slaves to somebody else who are forced to be prostitutes.
It's forced sex labor, right? And there's a lot going on that has been, I think, very cleverly excised from the series. It doesn't cause the series to lose anything. Maybe it de-ages it a little bit. It ages it down a little bit as opposed to like a TV MA rating, but
it's genius. Like the choices they've made, like they've made the right choice every single time. It
never feels like they castrated the series, right? It doesn't feel like they're pandering to try and get a bigger audience. It never feels like that.
Just to let you know, but here when the show started with like showing Dr. Singh running around, I was like, what the fuck? Because he's almost, at best, he's a villain almost in the comic. You know what I mean? He's conflicted, but he does a lot of bad things, and he doesn't get to repent for all of them.
So in this show, it feels like they've brought his storyline a little back, in that this is the beginning of him sort of doing those horrible things almost.
It seems that way, because that's one element. Like the whole preserve thing is a different aspect. Like where they're heading with the preserve feels more like where the comics introduced the preserve.
Okay.
But things like Amy's not in the comic at all. Wendy is. Some of those other hybrid kids look a little bit older than Gus. I think Extra's department was napping that day. They shouldn't be older than Gus. He's supposed to be the oldest one around.
Yeah. I was gonna say when you see the other sort of hybrids, the ages tend to look a little waffly. Also, there's also a sort of real mix of degrees of hybridness, I guess.
Because
like Bobby seems to have gone full on
groundhog.
Groundhog, yeah, that's the one.
Bobby's another thing. Bobby is like, the comic gets across this idea that you can understand looking at the comic why people are freaked out by the hybrids, because that Jeff Lemire's scratchy art style does that. Like looking at his people is kind of freaky when you see them on these stark backgrounds. But in this, I would die for Bobby. I don't know how anyone could hurt poor Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby's adorable.
Bobby's amazing. I was like, I wonder, because once I figured out where that plot line was going, I was like, I was wondering, okay, how are they going to do it? Because there's also a lot of the kids get hurt in the comic. I guess they just didn't want to do that either. Like there is like, they get out of a lot, those betrayals and reversals, there are a lot of plucky escapes, but people get hurt.
Do you see a lot more of the hybrids in the comics? Because in the show, I'm not saying you don't see a lot of them. It's just that you don't see a lot of their stories, right?
It's about the same. It comes later. Sometimes in later issues, they have individual issues that are dedicated to specific hybrids where you get a bit of their backstory. They're almost like bottle episode issues. But it's still really just focused on Gus and Jeopardy.
No, because in this version, we see Gus a lot, obviously. But then the aforementioned Bobby and Amy's daughter, Wendy, right? So she's also, we see a lot more of her later on in the show, but we don't really see a lot of, because, you know, we hear about the last man sort of kidnapping hybrid kids or stealing hybrid kids, but we don't really see a lot of that happening. Do we see that in the comics?
There is a kind of an undercurrent of like, either their parents died or freaked out. Like there isn't that many people left. Like I think maybe the show, because we see a little bit of the kind of the town and the train and things like that. The train, the concept of a train isn't around in the book. There's still, like, there's so many people are dead.
So it's more Walking Dead in that sense.
Yeah, much more Walking Dead. And so many of the children might have been raised on their own. And so that's why there is that surprise that Gus speaks. That, and, you know, that because people have just abandoned them. So they're a little bit more feral. Some of them are more feral than, you know, that comes into the how hybrid they are and how human they are.
The series is excellent in how underwritten it is as well, in that none of that's actually explained. It's all implied.
Yeah.
And you learn about it as the series progresses through these 8 episodes.
The way they've set this show up and the way the comic is only 40 issues, but the 40 issues ends very specifically. Like, it is, while it's Sweet Tooth's tale, it's also tied to another character in that there's an ending there. But there's an awful lot of space for this show to, like, this could be easily six seasons in a movie, you know what I mean? And with the way that these showrunners have invented new things to put in the show and how well they fit, and how well it's as I said earlier, it's its own beast, but they've plussed it in a way. Like, I really did not expect this to work out this well and to be this different and to be its own unique thing while still having this base to it. So there is so many places they can go now.
And you know what? The showrunners, I think Beth Schwartz in particular is one of the show's creators. She's had a lot of experience with comic books. I mean, she did Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow. I mean, she worked on almost all the seasons of Arrow.
They're very different to this show.
No. But what I mean is, you know, and she was the showrunner on the last 2 seasons of Arrow as well. But the way they expanded both of those shows with regards to, like, stretching it out and adding story elements and plots and working within that limited framework that DC often gives you where, you can't use this character, you can't use that, you can't do this, you can't do that. I think that's a lot of practice and training for something like this.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, she also used her Arrow experience to put in not one, but 2 flashback episodes.
2?
I know, but so, like, I was going to say, I think I agree with Uma. I think they've sort of younged this down. I think listening to you guys describe the comic book, I don't know if I'd have wanted that show. I think it's too dark. It sounds too...
Especially during a pandemic, right?
Especially during... I mean, it opens with... I mean, what was the number for this virus? H5G9. I'm like, calm down.
That's from the comic, which was written in 2009, right?
So I think in this day and age, not in this day and age, but at the current times we're going through, I think a show that sort of doubles down on people not caring for each other, people not caring for children, is harder to take than what they did here. I think here it's a bit more, I wouldn't say fantastical, but it feels a little not believable either, but a little easier to swallow, right? I think, and especially for the kids.
I don't know, man. I think I would say believable in the sense that suddenly watching Sweet Tooth isn't entirely outside the realm of possibility because we lived through a lesser version of...
No, absolutely.
I mean, everyone didn't die and there aren't hybrid children yet. But
maybe
we've seen, like, small versions of how people turn on each other in supermarkets. And
yeah, and I think, and that's my thing, like, I don't think a more accurate retelling of the comic would work as well here, because I just don't think people would want that. I don't think I'd want to sit through 8 episodes of that, you know, whereas this, it was easy.
This show actually leans into my number one complaint that I bring up all the time is I'm just going to just cannibalize the article I have written in the wrong order at the moment. It takes the temperature of what's going on in the world. Like, it has a virus plotline, but it doesn't, the comic shows you people literally warts and all with things happening to people. In this, they have brilliantly distilled it down to just that pinky thing.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Once you see that, you know, they establish that means that's sickness. That's all they have to show. They don't have to put people through the trauma of having to, you know, see people dying or coughing or anything like that. Because that's not what, one character does do it a bit, but we don't, you know, they just look like they have a bad flu. It doesn't put PTSD, COVID PTSD on anybody.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same with The Walking Dead. They've had a look at what's come out in post-apocalyptic movies and said, right, that's been done. There's no point doing that again. Let's do something different. And they've done that in every aspect of it. Another point you brought up there, just to bring that back to, neither of you guys have watched Love and Monsters yet, right?
No.
That again was, sure, everything could be that bad, but there's so few people left and the enemies aren't walkers or each other, it's giant bugs in that, it's of course we're helping each other.
Yeah.
Like the, 90% of the people they meet are helping each other. It's only one or two, it's only a small percentage of people who actually are going to be villains. This has a different balance, but it's still just that little bit more hopeful.
And I think that goes a long way to making this series as acceptable as it is during this pandemic. Because I think pandemic fiction is not something we need right now because we're living through it. And unless it's particularly good or particularly fresh, you're not going to want to watch something that reminds you of everything that is happening in the outside world. And I think the way Sweet Tooth handles it in striking that balance between, like you said, Ian, not showing you too much, everything is kind of implied and it creates an acceptance. And I'm not going to say that it makes it feel like fiction and an escape, because it doesn't, but it actually just makes it feel like something that you would want to watch right now despite the circumstances. And I think that's for me is the genius in the writing. Because what was that other show we saw but we didn't like, the one on Amazon Prime, I can't even remember the name, the remake of the Channel 4 series in the UK?
Utopia,
right? Which also had a kind of virus-themed storyline to it, and that execution was the exact opposite of this.
I'd be interested to see, just talking about all that, I'd be interested to see how the viewing stats for Contagion have done over the past while. Because remember when the pandemic started,
it was like number one, right?
Contagion, yeah. For some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone was like, oh, look, it's so predictive and prescient.
Yeah.
I think Sweet Tooth is just an absolute masterclass in how to adapt anything, a comic book, a piece of literature. It is the polar opposite of what Jupiter's Legacy was.
Yeah.
For me, it's right up there with Lupin as like one of Netflix's best shows of 2021. I have such a great time enjoy watching it. And also, it's one of those rarities these days where I actually wanted to binge the whole series and watch the next episode as it was playing. I mean, a lot of the time these days, and you know, because we have to watch so much stuff, I'm always like 2-3 episodes in. I'm like, all right, I'm going to take a break now. I'll continue tomorrow or whatever. And this one was so compelling. At the end of every episode, I was like, I need to know what happens to these people.
And also, it's so easy to do, right? There's n- it's not
it moves
too heavy.
Right. Yeah. There's a pace to it.
You're not, yeah. And I was gonna say, like, I was initially very reluctant. Oh, reluctant is not the word. I was very sort of apprehensive when they do all these sort of sides to, like, the story with the doctor. You know, it's suddenly off of Sweet Tooth. The episode with Amy, you know, again, off of Sweet Tooth. And I initially felt very, why are we here?
It felt like Amy should have been introduced earlier so that it was a character that was running through it, as opposed to episode 2 or 3 she was introduced, right?
I didn't mind it.
No, but I mean, like I don't, the storylines work. It just felt like,
yeah,
wait, you've established these characters. Why are you establishing more?
Why are we doing it here now? Yeah. And I was, you know, I was concerned that these characters would be, again, I hadn't read the comics, so I was worried that they'd just be throwaway guys. Like, oh, here's some background information. We're going to spend half an episode here and then you'll never see them again.
Or they'll die,
right? And I think the way they sort of weaved all that in, so you take breaks away from Gus and Jep, and I think that was really sweet, really nice. And it really kept, you didn't tire out with the Jep and Gus adventures because you were taking breaks with these other guys.
They also probably had to do that legally because kids can only work for so many hours a day.
That's
on movie
true.
Sets.
There's also that, yeah.
But I do wonder, like, some of the things that are in this, I wonder if it's because it's in its genesis, because originally it was pitched as a pilot to Hulu, and then WBTV and Netflix took it up, because there's, especially early on, there's a scene with a battle where someone being attacked, and the exact same scene is then in the next episode at the beginning. So it's more like weekly episodic television than a Netflix show. But the plus side to that is, like, my first notes when I was watching episode 7 was, oh, for fuck's sake, a flashback episode. Jesus Christ, Netflix. Jeez, the penultimate episode, every time you have to give us a fucking flashback. It's not the villain of the piece, but it's a character who's no longer around. I'm like, fuck you. And then 30 seconds later, this is great.
Yes. Yeah.
And then episode eight does the same. It's because it doesn't have that Netflix bloat. It doesn't feel like we're denying you, we're not pleasure denying you the finale you're waiting for. It's not like episode 6 has, and now we're going to fight, and then they go back into the past for a bit, and then the final episode is either 3 weeks later or some shit like that, where they just get over the big budget fight and things. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like a natural progression. And the story still moves through those episodes.
But it's the use of the flashback, right? I mean, so many times, and we've seen it in Jupiter's Legacy, we've seen it in a lot of shows, even Altered Carbon. The flashback doesn't always tie in directly into the episode in play.
It's a crutch.
It's a crutch as opposed to a storytelling element. And here it is a story element because as the episode progresses, the flashback begins to tie back into the narrative that's happening in the present. And yes, it cuts back and forth in a really clever manner
that's
to tell
what
you what is happening.
To
exactly.
Be
correct. It's
just like now it's like, well, our main plot line's a bit weak and we haven't got our A plot's weak. We don't have a B plot. What are we going to do? Flashback to that time he found a dog. Cool. You know, it's
yeah.
Unfortunately, it can become that. And I think that and the, you know, 3 days earlier trope as well is another one that can go get in the sea. But
I mean, for me, this one is the, I was going to say, take notes, Jupiter's Legacy writers. Oh, wait, you don't have jobs anymore.
The Jupiter's writer, they took one panel that said, wow, we all thought you were crazy when you told us about this island and we got on this boat and came with you. But man, you managed to convince us. That's it. That's the entire thing. And they made that a subplot for the entire series. And they didn't even, like, Jupiter's Legacy is 4 issues before they get to the fucking point of that comic, which is when one person kills another person and upsets the entire status quo. They didn't even get there.
This works. This works so well. With everything in account, I mean, you know, pandemic aside and the I wouldn't say unfortunate storylines, but the parallels of this show, it works. I think they've aged it down very well, making it not too much, not too emotional, not too edgy, not too depressing, not too dark.
That's it. It doesn't shy away from the darkness either. It's not too dark. But there are some moments which are pretty frightening, especially the kind of stuff that happens to Dr. Singh and with Dr. Singh. There are real moral dilemmas there which aren't that far removed from our own reality.
But I love that the Dr. Singh storyline is, it's not very easy for him either.
No.
It's not a, oh, well, I'm going to have to do it. Oh, shrug, you know.
We highly recommend Sweet Tooth. You have to check this out.
And don't just believe us because it's currently got 98% on the tomato meter from critics and 92% from the audience.
So we're definitely getting a season 2 then. Fingers crossed.
I hope so. Kevin Smith was raving about it as well, so I think, you know, he cried like a small child, so they're all shit, but it all helps when it comes down to getting, you know, everyone loved Teenage Bounty Hunters, and we can't go through that again.
No, God, no. Don't remind me. That's still a sore spot. Yeah, Sweet Tooth, streaming on Netflix right now. Do check it out. Let us know what you think. You know how to get in touch. GogglerMY is our social media. podcast@goggler.my is the email. You can also reach out on our hotline, 012-524-5208. Some of you have been reaching out for recommendations on what to watch, so keep that coming in. But for now, we highly recommend Sweet Tooth. By the time you listen to this podcast, the first episode of Marvel's Loki would have dropped on Disney Plus Hotstar. This would be the first Marvel original series that we are getting in Malaysia since the service dropped on June the 1st. So, hurrah to be able to watch all of this legally. Yay! Loki is a continuation of what happened in the middle of Avengers Endgame when, after a little dust-up with the Hulk, Tony Stark loses the Tesseract. Loki picks it up and kind of disappears in a flash of blue. This series explains where he goes and what happens next. And it literally picks up at that precise moment. He reappears in the Gobi Desert. And within seconds, he's apprehended by a new group of people who we've never seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe called Agents of the TVA, the Time Variance Authority. And basically, they arrest him and put him on trial for disrupting the sacred timeline. All of this may not make sense to you right now, but don't worry about it because the first episode does a great job in explaining all of that jargon and all of that gobbledygook, right?
They're time cops.
Kind of.
It's all a suit.
I mean, there's more, because there's the whole idea of the secret timeline and predetermination and all of this philosophical nonsense that they talk about.
Yeah,
because
I think the timekeepers are very good at, like, you know, setting up at 70s decor and setting up, you know, a time variance authority, but not so good on the terminology and glossary they should be using for their terms in order to not piss off time variance.
Exactly. So Loki gets put on trial, but Owen Wilson shows up as Mobius. Mobius, that's his name. So good, he had to say it twice. And he is an agent who decides to kind of pull Loki under his wardship and use him in stopping some time crimes that seem to be happening. I mean, that's all we'll tell you, because anything more is a little bit spoilery. And the show is very different from WandaVision and The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And I'll say it, I think I might prefer this to those two. Only because this show's fun. Like, this show is a lot of... those shows were very serious. Like, you know, with WandaVision, it was trauma and mental health issues and all of this stuff. Yeah, but
come on, it was also I Love Lucy, come on.
It was
Paul Bettany doing that thing with his face when he put it on.
But it was I Love Lucy through a mirror darkly, right? I mean, that was always present in that show. And you know, with all the questions of race and immigrants and refugees in the Falcon and Winter Soldier, I mean, yeah, there were light moments, but this show feels like sci-fi, time travel, rompiness. It's great. I loved it.
I think for me, the big thing that I really like is that the three shows that you've mentioned have all different, very different feels.
So
right?
Different.
They don't sort of all be, they're not sitcoms, they're not procedurals, they're all their own thing. And I think Loki takes on a different mantle. It feels it's a detective-y thing, it's a little spy caper thing. The music plays in all of that. I love the setup of the futuristic 1950s set that they're working with.
It's kind of 70s, I think, isn't it? It's a lot of Bakelite,
right?
Really shitty looking computers. It's like it's all underlit. Like it's like if Mad Men didn't have fluorescent tubes, right?
Because it's Get Smart meets the Jetsons meets like the British Avengers.
But it's also what that actually looked like in real life, because a lot of the time that decor would look kind of scuffed and dirty, and you know, it's government office. 1970s government office. It's the DMV.
Yeah. or some Malaysian government offices that I've been to. Where
in the current day, which, you know, they exist in a pocket time dimension.
It's just like, why is your light still this bad? You know? And I think and mix that with like hologram
projection.
Holograms, projection type things. And I think that first episode where they sort of laid out the Loki story by Mobius, I think, was beautiful. I think it sort of, again, sits you down and reminds you that this isn't the Loki that we've last seen in Avengers Infinity War. This is a much earlier iteration. This is when Loki was still the god of mischief. He still wanted to take over the universe, I guess.
He hasn't lived through shit yet.
He hasn't gone through shit yet.
He hasn't grown. So, he hasn't, you know, faked his death and seen Thor's reaction
several
to
times.
That.
Yeah.
He hasn't done cry for help.
Yeah, he hasn't done that yet. Yeah. I wish they pulled that up.
That projection scene, I thought, was the way it ended was brilliant, because when it was first happening, I was like, is this exposition really necessary? Like, is this just for people who haven't seen the movies? And then Mobius drops that line about his purpose and how, you know, he simply, I mean, because of course Loki is known for the I am burdened with glorious purpose, right? Which from the first Avengers movie. And it's not like he's just been, he gets a rug pulled out from under him when Mobius just goes, no, your purpose is so the superheroes can be better people. Like, that is the only reason you exist.
And shout outs to the first mention of Phil Coulson in the actual MCU in quite a long time.
No, okay, that was the one thing that really annoyed me. I'm like, hey, you could at least mention that even his death was a fake out and he was brought back to life. So you were duped even then, right? But I think Marvel are like, fuck you, ABC.
Maybe Mobius is holding that in his back pocket, and at some point Loki will meet Coulson and they'll have a chat or something like that, and it'll be all fine.
I just thought it was, this is seven seasons, we don't want to think about it.
But there is a beautiful tension to the heart of the show in that Loki still thinks he can pull the wool over the eyes of people who know everything about him. There's a beautiful scene when he's being processed, and it's like, please sign here to acknowledge this is everything you have ever said. And he says, what? And a new piece of paper comes out, and he has to sign that one.
Yeah.
And when he starts, like, he's trying to run a game. He's trying to play a game of Mobius. But Mobius is like, I know all your tricks. Like, he literally knows all your tricks. I know everything you have done and everything you would have done. There's no way you could trick us. And it's very clear that Loki still thinks he can pull one over on this guy and get away with stuff. And he can't.
Well, he's of two minds, right? And I love the way that plays out as well. Because on the one hand, you can see Loki's mind working, thinking, forget the Earth and Asgard. If I take over this place, then I'm really a god, right?
Yeah.
And even they have a conversation, right? Where it's like, what would you do if you went back? And it's like, you take over the Earth, then what? Take over this, then what? It's like, you know, it's like, it's going through this, and the questions that Owen Wilson's asking him about, like, do you enjoy hurting people and things like that? Like, it does, they're kind of, you know, those Play-Doh things where you shove the thing down and it comes out the other end like a sausage machine? They're trying to force him through some of that development that made him more likable, but not in a forced way, you know what I mean? Because they're getting the character there while keeping his mischievous elements.
And I think that's what's important, right? Because they're tying the character back into the comic book lore and also keeping him a villain. Just because he has his own show, it doesn't make him a hero. They're not trying to do a Venom where they take the villain, make him an anti-hero, or try to do the Suicide Squad thing where they're not really villains, you know? And it's not making the same mistake as Gotham or Joker where you're removing the villain completely from Batman. This is reinterpreting what we see of Loki, what we understand of Loki, and actually using the fact that you've pulled him out of 2012 to explain that journey he had all the way to his death in Infinity War, which is super fucking smart.
I think it's even in the second episode where it's like he runs a play on them and it's like, we knew you were going to do that, but he's like, well, when you're the god of mischief and people know you're the god of mischief, sometimes you have to try and do the mischief just to keep them on their toes kind of thing. And it's again this tension of like, will he actually, even the way the second episode ends, he can spin that multiple ways, right? It doesn't play like he's in trouble with the TVA, but could also be working with them. And
no, but I think as well that what you're saying is right, Ian, in that you're not entirely confident as to where Loki is falling throughout the first two episodes, right?
Yeah.
Has he switched sides, or is he still on, you know, is he still on his own side trying to do his own play? He keeps insisting to wanting to meet the heads of the TVA. Again, you don't know if it's just so that he could get sent back, if he could try and convince them to make him the fourth head.
But you know, yeah, that's it. He's he's got such a big head that he thinks that if I could just get in the room with these guys, I could win them over. The people who control time, I can easily win them over. He hasn't had that. We've had that conversation where he talked with Thor, where Thor's like, you're going to betray me always. You're always going to do this. This is what always happens. But they had that talk in the lift, right? You know, it was like, I know I can't trust you ever. I can never fall for that again. I still want to, but I can never act on it anymore. And you could see that impacting Loki thinking, oh, we can just keep doing this forever, but it's, you know, it's pointless. And it's going to be interesting to see if he gets there as well, because that Loki was growing up until the point he got stabbed by Thanos.
I think that journey that he goes, especially on Thor Ragnarok, Loki sort of really flips over to being less the god of mischief, to just being, okay, I need to stop doing that so that people can survive. You know, this is bigger than just me having a little bit of fun trying to take over the world. This is, holy crap, Thanos is here.
Well, I won't have a planet to take over because of Ragnarok.
To take
right?
over. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So whereas in this one, he still hasn't gotten there yet. And I think it'd be interesting to see if he gets there without having seen his father disappear, his mother die, Hera showing up and blowing up, you know, blowing up Asgard. And that is what would be interesting.
There's also a very interesting approach to this series that I quite enjoy, which is very different from Falcon and also WandaVision, in that there's a lot of stuff with just the two of them talking, like Mobius and Loki. Mm. And it feels a lot like theater, right? Because they're sitting down, they're face to face, they're talking about philosophy and questions of identity and self and all of this stuff in a very interesting and exciting way, which ties back into the comic books. And I think that's quite confident for, like, we don't get as much action. You know, Falcon and Winter Soldier opens with this aerial action scene unlike anything we've seen. And I think this show shows a lot of confidence in going, actually, we can just have these people talking in a room for the bulk of the first episode, and it'll be totally fine. We're not going to lose the audience. I think that's a bold choice. It worked really well for me. Yeah.
I mean, even in the first two episodes that we've seen, there aren't that many action sequences. There's a lot. No. There's a lot of character sequences. Like, I love the bits when Loki and Mobius were going through files. And that's what I mean. That feels very sort of, there's a procedure that they're going through. There's an actual investigation that they're going through, as opposed to cutting in and then cutting out, saying, oh, we found the solution, so that they can get to an action sequence.
Yeah, because Loki has to do the work. He's never done the work before because he's been able to just skip around and do stuff. Whereas here, it's like, here, you got to read all the files and you got to do stuff. And he might, I thought this was going to be more of a procedural from what we saw of the trailers, like that, the D.B. Cooper thing, which we won't really discuss, but if you Google that name, you'll have an idea of, you'll have a greater appreciation for a scene. It felt like, you know, it was going to be Time Crime of the Week in a certain way. And maybe later on it will, but there is very much a plot to it and an arc to it. And those procedural elements are fun. We'll hopefully see more of them. But even just to play on that, to come back to the theater thing, Loki destroys a salad was just a great little bit, right? Just.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a great, and it got, also and it a got great the point, explanation.
Yeah, great metaphor.
And I don't know. It's a combination of things, right? It's a combination of good writing and also Owen Wilson, because you're introducing a new character of Mobius. We know nothing about him, and yet he is immediately engaging and appealing as a character. Part of it definitely has to do with Owen Wilson. He has this charm about him.
It's Owen Wilson,
But also it's in the writing. When we first meet the character and they're in this church in France, this old cathedral in France, there is a banter between another agent and the way he deals with this kid who walks in like halfway.
Yeah.
There's something about the writing there that already tells you everything you need to know about who this character is and what his personality is like. I thought that was just a well-crafted scene.
Also, that was a great scene because it immediately tells you that this isn't the Owen Wilson we've seen in other movies. This isn't the stoner fun guy, right? This is there's a seriousness to him, right? There's a maturity to the character as well, that he's a little goofy, but not to the level of the Owen Wilson we've seen in the past.
There's a kind of a, like, you know, Loki's going through the ludicrous of the whole thing, and Owen Wilson just throws the ludicrous of Asgard and all that back in his face. But that is something that's going to be an interesting, another interesting thing about this show is, this isn't like, you know, the giant time lizard, timekeepers recruited people from all of time and space to work here. Apparently they created this from whole cloth.
Yes.
He kind of says that, like, Mobius and the judges, they were created by the time.
Mm.
Like, why do I keep saying time thinkers? The timekeepers. Like, they were created by them. So there's a weird element there to it as well, in that Owen Wilson's quirkiness is part of the plan, but also the judge's leniency or not is part of the plan. And
it's
what
all
the plan
part of the
is.
Plan, man.
Yeah. Owen Wilson is behind enemy timelines.
the writer, Michael Waldron, seems to be a new favorite of Kevin Feige. So he wrote Loki. He's apparently written Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness, and this show looks like it's going to be very closely tied in with that one, especially with setting up the whole idea of a Marvel multiverse. Kevin Feige has also apparently hired him to write the screenplay for his Star Wars movie too, so clearly this guy is a favorite. He's been on Community, he produces and writes Rick and Morty, so yeah, he's got a lot of time travel writing under his belt in that sense.
But also, like, I mean, the Rick and Morty thing is quite interesting in that
there's a bit of that here, right?
But not only that, but Ian did a great piece. Was it early this year, late last year, about how Rick and Morty may seem ridiculous, but they've thought out it, they've thought their storylines through. It's not a jokey thing.
Yeah, they put a tremendous amount of effort into a one-line throwaway gag that is. I think it was the line about the time thing, but they were literally on a narrative device, and it was like it went by so fast, and Rick went by the line so quickly, and I was like, that could have taken weeks to come up with, and they just threw it away.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
Well, there's more stuff going on. So will this lead to the council of Ricks meets the council of Mortys? Sorry, the council of Ricks meet the council of Lokis.
But you know what? If they put as much effort, or if he puts as much effort as he did on that show in this one, because I have to say, the time travel elements in Rick and Morty are some of the best thought out time travel elements in fiction. Mm. Like, there are fewer loopholes there than in a lot of other shows.
It also feels like they do it just for kicks. You know, Rick and Morty is a very sort of episodic show. So to put that much effort into a 130-minute episode that sort of goes forward and back and doubles back on itself and then backflips through it again just for the giggles is amazing.
Rick and Morty is like a trap designed by some kind of version of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in our universe to stop the minds who make Rick and Morty from designing actual weapons of mass destruction.
If they weren't doing this, their
powers would just be harnessed for evil. But I do wonder where we're going to go now with the rest of the season. So Loki's kind of hung up on this idea that, you know, he's a variant, so he's not supposed to exist because and he was also very prescient. He was aware that the Avengers came back in time to get the Infinity Stones.
Yes.
Because he said that.
Yes.
He said, like, oh, you shouldn't be arresting me. You should be arresting them. They came back in time. And they're like, oh, no, that was supposed to happen. So he's hung up on this idea that, like, no, you can't. It's chaos versus order. Whereas it's even outside that. Like, his chaos was contained within a certain thing, but he is now a variant because he goes outside it. And the TVA has been doing such a good job. We don't know what creates a variant, right? Because we haven't seen any before. All the time travel or anything else that's happened in the movies and everything else so far has been within the sacred timeline as far as
has been
know.
Part of the plan. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting because we're talking about this could set up a multiverse. We did think the same about WandaVision before they pussied out on that. You know, Doctor Strange may change title right before it comes out and says, ha, gotcha.
It's about Doctor Strange's mom.
Yeah, but I mean, two episodes in. How many episodes is there going to be in the series?
Six, apparently.
Six, yeah. Okay. So that doesn't give us a lot of time to play around with fun. Like they have a what if series coming, so they don't have to
also,
do that here.
Apparently there's a second season in development.
For Loki?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I would think that would be quite cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends what the disruption to the status quo in the second episode. It depends what they do with that, whether they roll it back, or whether that does give us the insights into alternate takes on the Marvel universe that we're looking for.
Marvel seems to be approaching this like they do their films, though. I mean, and I think that really works as well. In all of their series, they've had one director direct all the episodes. They haven't kind of... They've broken away from the showrunner approach as well. I mean, there's a head writer and there's a director, and they seem to construct these things like really long movies. And I think the director, Kari Skoglund of Falcon and Winter Soldier, said that her approach to it was that as well. She thought of it as 6-7 hour movie, right? But having that one director, I mean, you can really see like a vision throughout these three series, right? It feels like one unified piece. And I think a season two, I think the TV version on Disney Plus just gives them a different canvas to play with than waiting for those movie releases, you know, two or three a year, right? I think this is effectively a Loki film across 6 hours on Disney Plus. And so whatever definitions we put aside and or whatever we're calling it, it actually is just a very integral part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think a season two is entirely possible. It would just be like a Loki 2, for example. And yeah, as long as they keep telling good stories like this, it works.
Got to say as well, it's great to see Wundi Mosaku again. Like
after Lovecraft Country?
Yeah, although did you notice in the second episode, she's in Lovecraft County, she was also in his house, right?
Yes.
the Netflix thing. She's great. I think there was a few, I don't know if they did it again, whether it's preview copies or not. There was a few fixes in the previously on the second episode for the first one. It's like, I think Owen Wilson said, someone's been killing our men in the sacred timeline. And in the second one, it's like they're killing our Minutemen. I don't think he referred to them as Minutemen the first time around.
Oh, no, he didn't refer to them as Minutemen. No.
Right.
Yeah. And there was one or two little things like that where I need to watch it again, but there was something in the previously on. And I think that happened with Winter Falcon and Winter Soldier as well, right? There were scenes in the previously on that weren't in the previously on episode.
Not Falcon, that was on WandaVision.
WandaVision.
Yeah.
But with WandaVision, it was meant to be
that. I thought it was intentional. Yeah. With them just fucking about with everything, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
We had access to the first episode, so we've seen the first two episodes, which means we just have to wait a little longer to see the rest of it. But
we're also cursed now because we only have four left.
Only have four, yeah. So we've got to wait a little while, but we're really liking what we see so far. And also, given the MCO, it looks like we may have to wait a little longer to see Black Widow as well, because cinemas are still closed in Malaysia, and I don't think we're getting premiere access anytime soon. So we'd probably have to wait until July or late July before we can watch Black Widow. So yeah, I mean, this is going to kind of tide us over until then.
And what's the next Disney Plus show after Loki? Cause we had a couple weeks break since,
Hawkeye,
Falcon and Winter Soldier. Oh, Hawkeye's next.
But it's just listed as late 2021. So it might be closer towards Eternals time. I don't know.
Do we get What If in between?
No date for that yet either.
Is it not?
Yeah, I don't know. What If looks interesting. I think What If, actually, What If is the last bit that Chadwick Boseman did, right? I mean, he did the VO for Black Panther.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that? What If Black Panther is Captain America, or What If someone else became Black Panther, or was he? Can't remember. Was he Doctor Strange?
I can't remember. What if? So yeah, check out Loki. It's a lot of fun, and I think if you're an if you're a Marvel fan, you're going to check it out anyway. But if you're not a Marvel fan, I think Tom Hiddleston carries this thing really well.
He's a delight.
He is an absolute joy to watch. And it's nice that after all of this time, he still clearly seems to enjoy playing this role.
Yeah, and he gets to have the long hair again, because I think he lost that after the first couple, right?
Yeah, in Ragnarok, he went all short hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And he does have some fun flicking his hair around, which is great.
Yeah. Check out Loki. Let us know what you think of the first episode. You can get in touch on all of our social media feeds, GogglerMY, podcast@goggler.my, or even on the Goggler hotline. You can WhatsApp us on 012-524-5208. Don't forget to rate this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us out. Tell your friends, tell your family. And yeah, this is something we know you'd want to talk about. So reach out, and we're there for you. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Goggler Podcast.